This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. We're glad you've taken time to join us, especially if you are with those attention to detail folks who like to join us live, because for the podcast guys, you won't notice, but we adjusted our time a little bit because life is busy. So for those that have made us live, joined us live, always want to make the invitation. Go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show. If you have some observations you'd like to share or a question you would like for us to present to our guests during the course of the next hour, that would be the perfect place to do it. And because it is a little late, if you've got to roll out, or if you just happen to listen to this as a one-shot show and you would like to make sure that you catch all of Midrats and perhaps access some of our previous shows, please go over to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We're right there. Look for Midrats and go ahead and subscribe. It doesn't cost you a thing, and that way the show will be ready for you at a time of your leisure. And for today's show, we're going back again. History, heritage, ethos, institutional culture, all those things, they're more than just books, lectures, static displays, songs, stories, and rituals, especially when they involve an institution like the U.S. Navy, or if you're looking at people themselves. Those part of what we do, they tell a story, and they help build an institution. They add to that tapestry and can make it stronger. And cold, neutral parts, really the good things, especially if you tell them and you remind yourselves on a regular basis what they are, they really do make they make an institution what they are. And today we're going to look back 35 years ago, the USS Samuel B. Roberts, a Oliver Perry class frigate, which are all gone from the service now. But at the time, the Sammy B was just 2 years after her commissioning, and she struck a mine. And there's an incredible story there about resilience, about leadership, and also about a place in time in our history. And you saw reflections of a great U.S. Navy tradition involving damage control, whether you're looking at Commander Lippold's Cole, or you're looking at the events of 2017 with the collisions in Westpac with the Fitzgerald and McCain that we've talked about before. There's something that, regardless of what might be coming across the latest news wire involving our Navy, that it is that tradition that we have that we can all be proud of. And that's what we want to do today. 25 years ago, we had on our guest Bradley Pennison on, and here we are at the 35-year anniversary. 10 years later, we're going to have him on again because a lot's happened in the last 10 years, but the story still has more to tell. And so for the full hour, Brad will be joining us. He's the deputy editor of Defense One and is the author of what really is the reference book for the USS Samuel Roberts in 1988, his book, No Higher Honor, Saving the USS Samuel B. Roberts in the Persian Gulf. And we just lost Brad on the line. So Eagle One, I'm going to roll it over to you for a second because it looks like I need to call Brad right back.
Okay, I'm going to sing a collection of show songs from Rodgers and Hammerstein, South Pacific. No, I'm not. This is the joy of flying.
Sea shanties.
All right, I'm here now. Sorry about that.
That's okay, Brad. That's one of the flavors of live radio. You've missed my entire introduction, I think, but that's okay because you know who you are and you know the incident. But really, we appreciate you taking time today to to talk to us and the listeners of Midrats about the ship and the sailors of the USS Samuel B. Roberts. And one of the things I touched on in the intro, and we actually chatted a little bit about in the pre-show, was here we are in 2023, and we look back to the events of 1988 and Samuel B. Roberts. That 1988 was almost as close within a few months of the armistice of the Korean War that we are today to when the Samuel B. Roberts struck the mine in the Persian Gulf in 1988, and yet it seems really close to us, and we'll touch on some of those things, familiarity. But I thought for the listeners, because I know some of our listeners weren't even born in 1988, where, you know, for me, you, and especially my co-host, 1988 really seems like yesterday. I wonder if you could take a moment and set the table in place and time. We had the frigate Samuel B. Roberts. She was just 2 years after commissioning, and she found herself in the Persian Gulf in a dangerous piece of water. You know, what was that snapshot in 1988 when the crew woke up that was the world they were existing in?
Right. So the first thing you have to remember is that the Iran-Iraq war was going on. And you're making me feel old by saying how long ago it was. But it's so far in the past that people may well have forgotten. But the Iran-Iraq war started in 1980 when Iraq invaded Iran. And it had been grinding on just horribly. It was one of the most horrifically deadly wars of the 20th century. And after things ground to a stalemate on land, both sides took to the water, and they both essentially tried to slash at each other's economic jugulars by sinking the oil tankers that were hauling their oil out the Persian Gulf and then to the greater world. And so caught in this fray were the Kuwaitis. They were just trying to ship their own oil out, and their tankers kept getting harassed, bombed, and even sunk by both sides. And so the Kuwaitis entreated Washington. They said, hey, I know you don't convoy with third-party ships, but I wonder if we could work something out. And Washington said, not so interested. Whereupon Kuwait went to Moscow, and suddenly D.C. had second thoughts. Okay, let's see what we can do here. And the scheme they came up with was an operation called Earnest Will. They reflagged these Kuwaiti tankers. They painted out the names on the backs of the supertankers. Al Raqqa became USS Bridgeton, for example. Homeported in Philadelphia, and now under U.S. flag, these tankers could legally be escorted by the U.S. Navy. So this is where the Roberts comes in. It was, as you mentioned, I think you mentioned, it was just barely 2 years into commission in 1986, and it was dispatched it was commissioned in 86. In February 88, it was dispatched to the Persian Gulf to join this convoy operation, Operation Earnest Will. So it duly joined up. It duly escorted tankers from what they like to call the Kmart parking lot just outside the Gulf all the way down to Kuwait, drop them off, let them load up, escort them back, and various groups of ships were there. There were a couple dozen vessels, U.S. warships, doing this convoy duty at any time. So April 14th, 1988, the Roberts is coming back from one of these escort missions, and they are more or less in the exact center of the Persian Gulf when the lookout on the forecastle, about 4 p.m., hazy day, says, I see something. It looks like mines. So the OOD gets out his binoculars, looks out there, says, yep, that's what it is. Let's, all stop. The skipper happened to be below right at that moment. He was actually discussing, he was talking with his chief mess cook, asking why there was too much spinach recently. But when he felt the ship backing down, obviously he ran up to the bridge, got his own binocs on it, and said, yep, those are mines. So what are they going to do? Well, there wasn't much training on what a skipper or an OOD should do once they found themselves inside a minefield. But the skipper, Commander Paul Wrynn, looked back down his wake and saw it pointing six straight to the end of the Persian Gulf. He's like, okay, we got in let's try to get out. And so he told everybody, okay, set GQ, but please do it quietly. You know, no chaos, no loud noises. If everybody gets your battle stations. And then he put out his APUs, the little electric powered, you know, outboard motors that the Perry class had, and he started backing down. Now your audience probably knows this as well as anybody, but these were very simple mines that Iran was laying back then, and essentially they were to a 1908 design for the Russian Tsarist Navy. That's how old the design was, and it was very simple. You had a weight. You had an anchor that was supposed to rest on the bottom. You had a length of chain, and then you had a buoyant globe. And the globe was the cartoony mine that you see anytime anybody draws a picture of a mine. It's this thing. It's a sphere with little horns on it, and it is buoyant. And so the trick is that you're supposed to lay that chain so that you're supposed to measure that chain so that the sphere floats just below the surface of the water, so it's essentially invisible. So the fact that that everybody saw three mines on the surface meant that already these mines were not laid by the most competent of mine layers, yet they were out there, and since there were only three of them, there probably were more, and the rest of them were invisible. So Rin starts backing out. The Robert starts backing down its wake. The problem is that a blunt-ended frigate is not really meant to do that. It's like throwing a paper airplane backwards. You just really can't do it. And so they're backing down. Some people think they hear a scrape. Some people just are there when suddenly, boom, biggest explosion anybody's ever seen. Blows a truck-sized hole in the engine room, breaks the keel. Engine room immediately floods. AMR-3 immediately floods. AMR-2 floods, and AMR-3 starts to flood. And a Perry-class frigate is an 11-compartment ship, meaning that it can, you know, it's got 11 watertight compartments. It can lose any two of them and stay afloat, lose a third, and it's a lot dicier. Because here's one more thing, and then I'll shut up, and we can talk about whatever you want to talk about. But the Roberts was one of the tail-end Perrys. Bath and Ingalls have been building them for years. They built dozens of them apiece, and that meant that they were the late Perrys were as solid as any warship you can imagine. But they were also overweight for their design because, of course, as a class proceeds, everybody wants to put their new doodads on it. And I'm not saying that, you know, you don't want new systems and new sonars and new radars, but all of that adds weight. And the Roberts and the rest of the Perrys had been built to a very minimal standard. They're supposed to be cheap ships that they could produce a lot of. And so the bottom line is they lost two of their 11 compartments. Nobody knew whether they could lose a third and stay afloat. So there they were, late afternoon, April 14th, 1988. They're on fire. They're flooding. They're surrounded by hostile forces. I mean, for God's sake, there were sea snakes surrounding them in the Persian Gulf. It just could not have been grimmer.
Yeah,
let
me commend to people your book, No Higher Honor. Which it tells this story. In preparation for the show, I reread it, and it's a really good book, and it lays out a lot of the difficulties that confront people in these crisis situations. But more importantly, it really does a pretty good background of how these Perry class frigates came to be. I mean, since I was around during the Zumwalt era, and probably no. I remember, you know, that book, Patrol Frigate Design, and how that came to be. And you know, you work through that progression of how these ships came to be what they are and where the strong points and their weak points were, I think, really well. And I think one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the story of Captain Rin and his decisions about who he wanted to be as DCA, damage control assistant, and how that came to be one of the keys to the survival of a ship, and I think we can segue from that into lessons learned from the Roberts that the Navy either has or has not forgotten.
Yeah, sure. So Rin was in some ways a very conventional naval officer. In fact, he he signed up to be a SWO because his brother had been one before him. And so, you know, Rin's in high school and he's hanging out with his brother and the rest of the, you know, rest of his wardroom, I presume, when they came to New York City, which is where Rin was born and grew up. And he just thought, you know, he thought naval officers were just the coolest guys in the world. And so that's what he wanted to do. And so that's what he did after college. And went through, went to Marist College, then went through, SWO school, OCS, and now he's in the Navy. One of his first tours was aboard Riverine craft, in Southeastern Asia. They taught him, the Navy taught him Thai and taught him Cambodian and sent him up, the Mekong River, to command a squadron of riverine craft. And he actually got into firefights. He actually helped build bases in hostile territory. And he brought that experience back when he reported back to the more conventional surface fleet. So he goes through his various tours, DIVO and department head, and he gets picked for command. And he gets picked to command the Roberts. It's his first command. And he gets there. And the first thing he does while the ship is, you know, the hull is coming together in Bath, Maine, he pulls his chiefs together and he says, look, it's all going to start with you guys. You know, you're the experts here. But here, I want you to know how I'm going to run my ship. This is not going to be some second place ship. There's no second place in combat. And so we are always going to be the best ship. And so we're going to be the best ship there is. I mean, he did not lack for vision. But he said, here's the key, okay? The key is that everybody aboard this ship must come out of it thinking there was nothing he could have done better with his life for those 3 years. That we're going to have pride, we're going to do it right, and we're going to be recognized as the best ship. And that's how he approached it. And he got a goat locker who was ready to back him up on that. He got officers who were signed in, and he got a crew who was ready to roger up to it as well. So one other thing that you alluded to, Sal, was the way he chose his damage control assistant. And, time was when DCA was a junior officer billet, and for many, many places it still is. And the thinking was that, you're just running, you're running drills here. You know, you don't need anybody who's super experienced. You don't need anybody who, super senior. You just need somebody to make everybody do their drills and check the boxes. And that's not how Rin approached it. Rin said, if it comes down to really needing the skills that a DCA imparts, then I don't want to have some junior officer doing that. I want somebody who's got the pull aboard ship to make sure that we drill aboard ship as much as we need. So he gave the job to Eric Sorensen, who was a senior lieutenant on board. And Sorensen had been on other ships, and he thought that he was in line for maybe CSO, maybe combat systems officer, or, possibly CHI. But he was not happy to get the DCA assignment. But Rin told him, look, Eric, I've met you, I've worked with you, I know what you are, you're a bull, and you won't stop at anything to get what, get your mission done. And you're going to be DCA, and you're going to do it, and you're going to train our crew the right way. And that's what happened. And sure enough, Sorensen took the mission on, and he typed up his own DCA booklet. He thought the Navy's booklet was trash, so he threw it out. He typed up what he thought should be the way that these sorts of things were run, and then he drilled the hell out of the crew. And he talked to any member of the Roberts, any member of that plank owner, any of the plank owners from the Roberts, and they're just like, oh my God, Eric Sorensen, Jesus, just eats DC for breakfast. He would not quit, not let us do anything. And of course, that ultimately paid dividends. We haven't gotten quite up to the point where in the story where they actually, face the problems, but we can move into that. But I think that gives you a little bit of the sense. And, oh, I'm sorry, Sal, one more thing that made Rin unusual. Not only did he bring, actual combat experience, close-up firefight, pulling triggers, combat experience, not only was he farsighted enough to put a senior person in charge of the DCA job, but he also thought heritage was very, very important to motivating and imparting a sense of mission to a crew. And so his ship was a Samuel D. Roberts. Well, who was Samuel D. Roberts? He went off and he found out who Samuel B. Roberts was. He was a Navy coxswain who served off Guadalcanal in 1942 and who gave his life to save Marines during one particular evacuation. He steered his whaleboat back and forth to draw Japanese fire so the Marines could get off, took a bullet in the neck, died on an evac flight, and got the Navy Cross for his valor. That was Samuel D. Roberts. The first ship named after this Coxswain Roberts was DE-413, which was one of the small boys who fought off the Japanese center force, the giant super battleship centered force that came around and was in a position to wipe out the landing at Leyte on the Philippine islands. And so this was part of the Battle of Leyte Gulf, you know, world's biggest naval battle. And the turning point was this battle off Samar that the first ship Samuel D. Roberts was part of. So Rin said, okay, we got a fantastic name. We've got a sailor we can emulate. We've got a ship we can emulate. Everybody's got to know what Samuel B. Roberts is on our ship. We're not going to be some ship where nobody knows who the name on the fantail belongs to. And so that was the third thing I think that really made him stand out, was that he had this interesting approach to imparting pride and mission to a crew.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought the part of the heritage, and I touched on it a little bit in the intro. Is it really is important, because in many ways, and I think you outlined, as Captain Wren did, that it helps you set standards. It helps you understand as a reference point. You know, you had DE-413, you had also DD-823, also the Samuel B. Roberts, mm-hmm. and then of course we had FFG. 58, and when I'm looking forward to the next frigate class we have coming online, the Constellation class. The first three they've named is going to be Constellation, Congress, and Chesapeake. And kind of a little pet peeve of mine, and I've joked a lot with a friend Jerry Hendricks about this, and we've done it on the show too with the three of us, that I can get an eye twitch with some of our naming traditions. And unfortunately, we lost Captain Wren. He passed away, I believe, last September, about 8 months ago. But, you know, the name Samuel B. Roberts, and there are other names that really have a tradition where you've got an 18-year-old sailor just out of boot camp showing up for his first command, can walk across the quarterdeck and can reference where he is to what has gone before in the history of our Navy. It's kind of, I guess it's really not off topic here, because it made a difference to how the Samuel B. Roberts fought, because they knew where they came from. When we look at the naming of the Constellation class, you know, if you had a chance to bend an ear or something, there's a hint that they get a little bit of our history, because Congress and Chesapeake were ships, but there are some great names that aren't in our fleet that probably really should be. And I think you probably agree the Samuel B. Roberts, along with a few of their other friends in Leyte Gulf, there's some great potential with this new class of frigates that we can bring some names back into our Navy.
Oh, no doubt. I've written an op-ed on just that point. Proceedings was kind enough to publish it some years ago. And we shall see. You know, these things take time. My own eye twitch, Sal, is when we name ships for living people. And as recently as 1970, the Navy actually formalized a policy that said, you know, we don't do that. And then they broke it 3 years later with the Carl Vinson. So, you know, I think I read somewhere that the Navy has a long tradition of not naming ships after living folks, and an equally long tradition of doing so. So of breaking that tradition. So, you know, we shall see. But I will tell you this. I actually looked at a list of ships named for living people, U.S. Navy warships named for living people. And there was a burst right at the beginning of the Navy when it seemed like every other ship was named for George Washington. And then we had a couple of Thomas Jeffersons and then a couple of other, you know, early founding fathers. But then really it didn't happen that much, you know, maybe 10 times in the 1800s, maybe, you know, 10 times through the middle of the 20th century. And then in the last couple decades, that's just fallen apart. And we've gotten to the point where since 2020, we've had 7 ships named for living people, which is about one every 8 months. And 3 of those, not to bag on SecNavs, but 3 of those were for former secretaries of the Navy. So, you know, it's one thing to name it after, you know, a ship that's been through fire and hell and sailors who've done, you know, wonderful things. And, you know, it's another to name it after a politician, I think.
My, I have a distant relative who was the only Secretary of the Navy who got blown up when a cannon exploded way back when.
Oh, sure.
Gilmer. He's the only Secretary.
Oh, Gilmer.
Of the Navy.
Oh.
Yeah. Only Secretary of the Navy.
We should name the safety
while...
center after him.
or at least the stand well back zone. You know, they could call it the Gilmer zone. But yeah, the political ones are the ones that really get me. The temporary expedient of naming after somebody who has some immediate political meaning that is difficult to reconcile with some of the great names that we have for our ships. But when we're talking about the Roberts, and they go into this convoy operation in 1988, they run into a mine, and you can take it from the damage. But 2 years later, or maybe it's 3 years later, 92, 4 years later, let's see, 91, when we're back in the Gulf, we've got the Tripoli and we got the Princeton both running into mines. In the very same, basically the very same waters that the Roberts got hit on. Where is the Navy in the period between the Roberts running a mine and the Princeton and the Tripoli? What happened to the Navy mine force that they're not out there protecting these ships?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure you guys have heard the saying that, you know, nobody ever got a medal for standing on the bridge of a mine. Mine warfare is just one of those neglected corners of the naval enterprise. You know, that it's always kind of working on really old ships with older equipment. And I don't mean to completely harsh on the Navy. In the past 10, 20 years, they've done really good stuff with remotely powered vehicles, and you know, it's a whole new ball game now that you can send out little robots to do that. It's getting much better. But you know, you're saying, you know, why did the Princeton run into a mine? Why didn't they have more minesweepers? Well, you know, I don't know. I will tell you that in those 3 years, the Navy did modify ship's equipment and procedures to improve damage control so that its ships would be more ready to handle the kind of damage that happened to the Roberts. There are, you know, little tiny things. More gate valves were added to fire mains. More emergency tag out procedures were developed. They had more first aid gear added to the repair lockers. All of these are from the Roberts and the Stark as well. They also added a line to the regs that said that if you're in a minefield, or you expect to be in a minefield, or you expect to take a torpedo hit, pull everybody out of the bridge, out of the bilges. You know, make sure they're up above deck so that they don't get lost in, you know, the first sudden swell of water if the hull gets breached. So, you know, the Navy did its best to learn lessons and to change things in those early years. But it's still, you know, I think, missing a good component of what it should have for mine warfare.
Even in the last year, you know, we saw, and yeah, I love how you described the fact that, you know, it's a over 100-year-old mine design, but nothing can shut down a waterway, even in 2023, than for somebody to yell or to see a mine. And we saw that recently in the Black Sea during the Russo-Ukrainian War. Early on, we haven't heard anything recently, that we had John Conrad on. From G Captain. I know him and Sal Marcogliano are always two guys we want to go to when it talks about merchants. And all it takes to stop merchant ships is not necessarily some old, you know, horn with acid chewing through metal arming mechanisms hitting a ship. It's just the threat of it, because insurance rates go through the roof. And there's NATO has a great mine warfare center up in Zeebrugge, and they got a great book there that outlines the numbers and types of mines, where they're all located over the globe. And even though that it doesn't get the attention that it has, occasionally mine warfare, even within the last year, it does still tap everybody on the shoulder and to remind them they haven't gone anywhere. And you don't have to be a first or even a second world power to be able to shut down major sea lines of communication just by throwing some 120-year-old mines out the back of the ship.
Yeah, no, indeed. And you're absolutely right about merchants insurance and shutting down commercial lines. But just to bring it back to the point of the U.S. Navy, let's go back to Operation Earnest Will when it started in 1987. The very first convoy, you had three small boys escorting the USS Bridgeton, the reflagged Kuwaiti tanker that was now sailing with Philadelphia home port. Anyway, they're going through the Persian Gulf, and the three Navy surface combatants are kind of spread out around the Bridgeton, surrounding them. You know, they're moving down the thing, and then bam, the Bridgeton hits a mine, and the skipper of the Bridgeton describes it later as a 500-ton hammer coming down on the front of his ship, and the whole thing, you know, kind of porpoises and goes up and down. But the crazy thing is, the Bridgeton, since it was a tanker and had double hull, was still seaworthy after the outside hull got hold, but the inside hull held. And so after everybody, you know, realized that the ship wasn't going to sink, they got underway again. But this time, the Bridgeton was leading the convoy, and the three Navy ships were trailing along in its wake because, you know, what merely damaged a tanker could very well send a Navy destroyer to the bottom.
Yeah,
and in fact, one other thing, too, fact and figure for you, one other thing, and you guys probably know this as well, the weapon that has sent more Navy ships to the bottom since World War II, most of these were in the Korean War, but still, is the naval mine. It's not gunfire, it's not missiles, it is mines.
You'd be pleased to know that on the wall of the room I'm in, I've got a poster from the Naval Controller Shipping Organization, and it is an image of the Bridgeton leading three U.S. warships in that scenario you just described. It's kind of funny that became the symbol of the Naval Controller Shipping people.
The poster child, so to speak, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that we really need to talk about is the improvement, and you mentioned some of it already, in the damage control world as a result of the Roberts. And, you know, I think there's a new surface trainer in Hawaii that's based on the Roberts. But, you know, we've also seen that in the incidents of the McCain and the Fitzgerald and a whole bunch of other ships, it seems like that the crews are doing a magnificent job under some pretty stressful conditions managing the damage control stuff. Can you talk about that a little bit? Is this something you've been focusing on? Or
yeah, no, I think you're right. The damage control efforts on both of those ships was outstanding. You know, the ships took big hits and deadly hits, and yet the ships managed to you know, they stayed afloat. So, you know, bravo Zulu. I do know as well that damage control, you know, immediately after the mining of the Roberts in 1988, it took a big step up. People started to get serious. I mean, the U.S. Navy almost lost a ship to this 100-year-old mine. Let's get serious about this. And so, you know, part of it were reviewing equipment. What can we do to make ships more seaworthy or damage resistant? I guess, you know, what can we do about training? It all got more focus. This is interesting. I think one way that you can track this is that Rin became something of a legend in the surface community, and he, you know, for the rest of his life, which, as you say, ended last year, but for the rest of his life, he was sought after by naval schools, by chiefs of operations, by groups of sailors, by ships, to come and talk about how he did this. How did he forge his crew, and how were they able to meet the moment with the superb damage control operation? You know, he must have talked to hundreds, possibly thousands of audiences over the year. And I think it really made a difference. You know, people wanted to hear it. People wanted to hear what he had done to survive, and they wanted to know how they could get their ships and crews and sailors to survive. So I think that it's a testament to the Navy's ability to learn lessons, ones written in blood, but, you know, they did learn it, and they did, and they have applied it. And so the lessons of the Roberts are now taught in, you know, in at SWAS, at Service Warfare Officer School, at, you know, at boot camp. I think it's safe to say anybody who's coming up through the Navy these days knows what the Roberts did and knows what the major lessons were.
Another thing that it brought back to mind, looking at the book and reading back over the Samuel B. Roberts, kind of going back in a way to my opening question, is in 1988, I was just a first-class midshipman myself, It was the Navy, of course, was much larger, but you had some great home ports. The Samuel B. Roberts was not the only ship that was actually home-ported in Newport, Rhode Island. We had ships that were home-ported on the East Coast, in Charleston, and Philadelphia, New York City. I'm probably missing a spot or two as well. I know on the West Coast, you could be stationed in Los Angeles. And with some of the issues they've had in San Diego, where they only have enough room for sailors to park their car anymore. That's also kind of a place in time with our Navy. You know, you're talking about heritage and having a reference mark is, I think one thing we've lost since 1988 is it used to be that near major population centers and sometimes in major population centers, the Navy had a presence. You had your local warships that weren't museum ships. They were actual sailors out in the economy. The kids were in the schools. And, you know, here we find ourselves in 2023, and everybody's just concentrated in a few ports. And it seems in a way that has kind of made our Navy a little more distant than it was in 1988.
Yeah, you may be right. And you know what? You remind me of the last time I was in New York City. I went to the Transit Museum, which is a wonderful museum. It's in a disused subway station, and they have lined the tracks, lined the platform in this subway station with old subway cars, and so they're all the way back from like the rickety, you know, cast iron ones to the, you know, the more modern, you know, streamlined ones. But you can go through these things, you can see the advertisements decade by decade change on the interior of these subway cars, and one of them from I think it was 1950 struck me because it was essentially a schematic map of New York City. But what the map was where you could see the various home-ported Navy ships. And there were like 15 of them going up the coastline of Manhattan. And it was being advertised on this subway car. Hey, get off at 49th Street to see this battleship. Get off at, you know, 53rd Street to see this destroyer. And it just... For those of us who still like going aboard ships, even if they are museum ships, you know, what a treasure that must have been. But it also says, it was just a different era when somebody could get off their subway car and go see a Navy ship. And you're right, it's a lot harder for a lot more people now.
Well, part of it, I mean, you've told a great story in this book, and the book is being used to train. It's on the CNO's list of recommended reading, and I assume that a lot of people who are going to DC school are reading it. Let's talk a little bit about the Navy's inability to tell its story very well. I mean, here's some great stories. We have these wonderful, you know, if you start from damage control stories, the kamikazes attacked on the Laffey back in World War II, you know, five or six kamikazes hit a ship survives. And sails back home and goes into Seattle to a hero's welcome. And they didn't even clean up most of the damage so they could show what the effect of the war was. But we don't seem to be doing that kind of story. Everybody seems to be covering their rear ends rather than extolling the virtues of the importance of having a strong fleet and the ability of these the magnificent young sailors we have to deal with a lot of things that most people their age, and I'm using sailors that I work with who are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, they were doing wonderful things and nobody really seemed to know it. And unless you, maybe you get a movie like Top Gun or Top Gun Maverick where you can see these sailors on the flight deck actually doing stuff. You know, how do we tell a story like this, like the Roberts, and make it more interesting to people than whatever it is we're doing now?
So at West 2022, so the big conference that takes place out in San Diego every year, this very issue came up, and Congressman Luria, Elaine Luria, who was she got voted out in the last election, but at that point she was still, a strong voice in Congress, I thought, for exactly what you said. How can the Navy tell its story better? And she, of course, is a former sailor herself, so, you know, she had a very strong opinion on the matter. But she looked at, kind of the Navy's Twitter feed, and she said, look, does the average person know what choke points are? What is all this jargon that we put out there? She said, and we expect people to understand it first of all, but then to get viscerally engaged with it the way that they would have to be if they were going to come enlist or even support the Navy in their voting habits. She made a big deal in her last term of just do storytelling. Don't use these bureaucratic words that nobody's going to understand. Get out there and say what the Navy does. So I think your question is very relevant. I think it's also received. I know, for example, CNO Gilding was there and in the audience while she was taking the Navy to task on this. So he knows about it. And where we go from there, I don't know. If there's some Hollywood producer out there who wants to set the story of the Roberts to a feature film, sure, I wouldn't say no.
Yeah, I am really surprised that nobody has had the opportunity to do that, because it's an incredible story, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to you can't talk about everybody on the crew, and when you have a ship hit as hard as the Sammy B was, and she still comes home on the back of a Dutch heavy ship carrying her on the back, it takes the entire crew. There's a huge story there that doesn't have to be a multi-billion dollar. And you don't have to create characters. They exist in real life. It's one of those things, Captain Wren, he spent a lot of time talking about what he did, but he was always the man and the leader he was. Just an event had to take place for that to be revealed. And our fleet and our Navy is just, you can't throw a penny without hitting one. Just an event hasn't taken place to reveal that part of the story. And, we've talked about the DCA. We've talked about the skipper. As that ship was hit, what were some of the other major players that really stand out, that if somebody was going to do a screenplay, you would definitely want to have an A-list type actor to play that role?
Well, I think you'd got to have Mike Tilley. Mike Tilley was he was a young sailor out of Missouri. Basically joined the Navy to get away from his tiny town in Missouri, and he had a knack for getting into trouble. He had leave off the ship and in home port and had a few too many beers and relieved himself. The only problem was he did it in front of a plate glass window in front of a big restaurant full of people, and so Rin found out about that and dressed him down. He tried to pass a fake ID. He just did a bunch of different things. But after the third thing, when he came to Captain's Mast, everyone was like, Tilley, I can't have this. And Tilley said, no, sir, I really am going to do better. I promise. The Navy's the only thing I got going for me. Please give me one more chance. And Rin, who was in most aspects, most respects, a no-nonsense guy, saw something in Tilley, so he let him stay. So fast forward then to 14 April 1988, and Tilly is a fireman. He's an engineman trainee, and he's down manning one of the four diesel generators aboard ship. And the order gets passed. Okay, everybody, get out of your bottom spaces. You know, come up a couple levels, couple of decks. And Tilly says, you know what, I think I'm just going to stay here with my diesel generator, because if we need it, we're really going to need it. And guess what? They really needed it. The fire and the flood and the blast knocked all four of the generators offline. It knocked three of them off immediately, and then eventually the fourth one was overloaded, and it shut down as well. So now they're on fire, they're flooding, they're sinking, and they're without electrical power. So they are screwed. But they've got Tilly. Tilly is down there inside the generator room, and he's doing everything he can to get it restarted. You know, he's trying process A, he's trying process B, and nothing's working. And so finally, he's got one thing left. And you guys know this, and much of your audience, I imagine, know this as well. But what you can do on some of these big generators is you've got a reserve flask of high-pressure air, and you can get in there and you can manually open that up, and that'll start the generator if you're lucky. And if you're not lucky, the generator just kind of throws a piston or blows up, or you know, whoever's on top of it pushing that lever, it's not a good day for them. But it was already not a good day for the Roberts, and so Tilly says, okay, I'm going to do this. I can't get the generator started any other way. We're all down here with our battery-powered battle lanterns. Nothing good is happening. I'm going to do the suicide start. So he climbs up on board this generator, closes his eyes, pushes the lever, and my God, the thing starts up. And Rin didn't know this. Nobody else in the ship knew this. All they knew was they had no electrical power, and all of a sudden they've got one generator back online. So pumps start working again, you know, fight the fire. That's great. They only discovered Tilly's heroics down in the generator room like hours later. And he kept asking to come up after that. And they're like, no, are you kidding? Sit down there. Go, keep drinking grape soda. Make sure that thing doesn't stop. Anyway, I think that, you know, who needs an A-list actor? I think Mike Tilly does. He's a great guy. I've met him. I talked to him for the book. And he's, you know, really this guy who was a screw-up. The Navy was really what he thought was his last chance. Screwed up in the Navy. Rin took a chance on him, and he was instrumental in saving the ship from mortal peril.
You know, that's exactly the kind of story that we need to tell. And it's not just the Tillys of the world. There are, you know, you could barely throw a rock on a ship and not find some kid who is done something extraordinary like that. Maybe not quite to the level of Tilly, but we don't get all the credit goes to other people. You can't make a ship like the Roberts work without a screw up like Tilly doing the right thing at the right time, exactly the right time. That I think if that can be dramatized somehow, that's the story the Navy needs to tell about the workers and the inner workings of the ship.
Yeah, I agree. I when I was a reporter, I was a reporter for Navy Times for a few years, and my favorite talks were always with the people who did the unsung, almost unknown jobs. The people who made the plumbing work, the people who kept everything clean, the people who did, you know, the horrendous jobs down under where they never saw the sun, but they did them and they were vital, and that's why the ship kept going.
Yeah, I know there was a little production, I think actually either the Australian Navy or our Navy made it, of the collision back in the 1970s with the Australian's last aircraft carrier that told that story. It really can, you know, makes you cringe, the mistakes were made. And I was thinking of your book and how well it told that story when I read the report from 2017 with the collisions of the Fitzgerald and the McCain, that, you know, there are two stories here that would be fascinating to see done in a dramatic manner. One is what happened up at the bridge, but also what happened in berthing and damage control, that there are some sailors, probably a couple who have some NJPs behind them that really rose to the occasion, like we always see in our Navy, in our military in general, But again, going back to a previous point, and not to say anything about the Norwegians, but you know, the Norwegians hit a rock and their frigate sinks. Our frigate hits a mine and it lives, and a lot of it has to do with the fact of some of the challenges we've had converting the Frem class frigate that the Italians and the French have had for years into what we're going to call the Constellation frigate, is the fact that we're a little nitty-gritty about damage control, but for the right reasons, especially for what the Sammy B showed us. I think another lesson that I wanted to make sure that we touched on is in the finest traditions of the Naval Service is if you're going to kick us in the knees, be careful. Is right as a result of this, we came into Operation Praying Mantis, which we traded a mine for something else for the Iranians. If you could outline a little bit how we reacted to the mining of the Sammy B.
Right. So Praying Mantis took place on 18 April, so 4 days after the mining. And so in those 4 days, you had a team of Navy SEALs who dove into the water, EOD divers who went into the minefield, and they pulled up a couple of mines. And because SEALs had seized an Iranian mine layer some months before, they were able to match the serial numbers. And so they had the evidence. They had the receipts. They had caught Iran red-handed. And so the decision was made in the White House by President Reagan, we are going to retaliate. And so there were various courses of action debated. You know, should we go after their Navy and harbor? Should we blow up another oil platform? And they ultimately decided to do something in the middle. They had actually tried blowing up oil platforms a few months previously, it kind of worked, but obviously did not have the deterrent effect that they wanted. So they thought that was too little. We also don't want to attack naval bases, they decided. We don't want to attack Iranian territory. That's too much. So they decided that what we're going to do is we're going to sink one Iranian vessel. And so over the course of 8 hours, they did, in fact, actually attack a couple of oil platforms. They went after a few gunboats, bog hammers, they were called. They sunk a few of those. And ultimately, they did sink a frigate, one Iranian frigate, and very badly damaged a second. So, you know, that was about half the striking power of the Iranian Navy at that time. So that was the retaliation. You mine our ship, and we'll take out half your Navy.
Seems like a fair trade.
I tell you one thing, actually. Wait. If you want, you'd ask what Rinds and what the Roberts effect on the Navy was. And I've got a quote here, actually. This is from Brian McGrath. He's a retired captain. I bet you guys know him, or at least know of him. Former CO of the Bulkley, the destroyer Bulkley. Under McGrath, he's not just some CO either. He himself won the Zumwalt Award for leadership, and the Bulkley won the Arizona Award for battle-ready ships. So, you know, he knows whereof he speaks. And he said, and we quoted him, I quoted him in the obituary I wrote for Wren last year. He said, Captain Wren had enormous influence in the way the captains who commanded after him approached their job. What we all heard from our captains, and what we all heard from the training pipeline was a similar story. We're going to practice this over and again until it's perfect. And then we're going to practice perfectly over and over again. And I think that really sums up, you know, the dedication to training and being ready that Rinn exemplified and that I think the Navy has ever since tried to live up to.
Yeah, Brian's a good friend of our program. We've had him on a number of times. And I'm glad to hear that lesson reached to the following commander COs. That's an important lesson. Train like you fight, like you'll fight, and yeah, things tend to work out the way they should work out. Before we move on to something else, any other lessons that we need to on the 35th anniversary that we need to grab from the Roberts and from the Stark and some of those other adventures that went on in the I call it the Arabian Gulf back in those days?
Well, I think two of the biggest lessons that the Roberts holds is, first of all, never underestimate your enemy. As we said a couple of times, this was a 100-year-old mine design. It probably cost about $1,000, and it nearly sent a Navy warship to the bottom. Cost $96 million to return her to service. And she was returned to service, and she served for more than a decade after that. So it served perfectly well, but was laid low by the lowest of low tech when it comes to naval warfare. So that's one. The second lesson is heritage matters. I didn't go into exactly what happened during the damage control effort, but I will tell you this, that as the sailors ran to and fro, pulling out hoses, pulling shells from the magazines that were getting warm from the fires, they had to pass the quarter deck over and over, because that's just how a frigate is laid out. And on that quarter deck was a bronze plaque that Rin had commissioned before Roberts ever set to sea. And on this plaque, it had the name of the first Roberts ship, DE-413, and the names of all the men who fought aboard her. So, you know, a big thing, 18 inches by 3 feet, you know, big hunk of bronze. But it became a touchstone, and quite literally, because during the moment of peril, the crew would run by and they'd slap the plaque for luck or for remembrance, or just to say, okay, other crews have done this before. Other crews have been in peril and they've come through. We can too. And that's all about the power of heritage. And I think that's one that the Navy should never forget.
Yeah, it's that reference point that people need. It's comforting to know other people have done this before and had harder, you know, fear not and head forward type of thing. The one thing I wanted to cover before we ended up the hour is one thing people don't know about you, and it's kind of timely, is you are, I don't know if this is something to get depressed about or something to be proud of, but you are one of the last cohorts to get a degree in Soviet and Eastern European studies that you got from Yale in I believe, 1990, before the Soviet Union decided to collapse. And you actually, after you graduated, you went over to Moscow right after the Soviet Union disappeared and modern Russia has. We all have an idea of the type of intellectual effort a young man or woman makes to get an undergrad degree, especially in an area at that time that you started your undergrad period, and you watch that whole change take place, that you never, even though you do other things in your life, you write books, you create websites, you edit major publications, but your mind never really leaves that area you invested so much of your youth in looking at and studying and researching, and in your case, living for a little bit. And, you know, here we are 14 months into the Russo-Ukrainian war. I just wanted to ask you, Brad, you know, what somebody from your background and your perspective, you know, we look back 35 years, we'll just back up a few more to the where you saw the Soviet Union fall to here we see the largest land war in Asia, Russians versus Ukrainian using roughly Soviet equipment. You know, what are some of the things the last 14 months or so, 15 months, keep coming to mind as you've watched these events unfold?
So the reason I embarked on a Soviet studies degree in the first place was an excellent teacher I had in high school. She was a history teacher, Mrs. Mosseri, and she taught a senior course on Russia. And so I loved her U.S. history course. And so senior year came along and I took her Russian studies course. And one of the things she taught was that in Russia, maybe, you know, at least as clearly as in any other country, you see cycles of history. And one of the things about Russia is, you know, go back to Peter the Great and, you know, Russia will go through a Western leaning phase and then a withdrawal phase and back and forth. And Russian leaders will alternate between trying to westernize their country and then trying to exploit the feelings that they have for their own, you know, sort of sweet, generous nature. And so I think, you know, you asked me how I regard what has happened. And I think I just feel foolish, not for having learned about Russia, but for having forgotten this essence of Russia, kind of in the 2010s, that it it westernizes, but then it withdraws again. And, you know, this is what we're seeing, you know, more in more extreme fashion than we have in a century, but it's still the same thing. You know, you listen to Putin and listen to his excuses for why he had to go into Ukraine, and they are echoes of the past and the Russian Empire and what it had to do. It's not a break. It's continuity. It's just the cycle coming around again.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but in the wee hours of the night, Brad. But thank you so much for coming on. It's been a great pleasure. I highly recommend your book, No Higher Honor. It is I think it's timeless. It's a very important book for everybody who cares about what happens at sea and what happens in the United States Navy. And it's a great sea story in so many ways. So thank you for coming on, talking about it again, and sharing your thoughts with us tonight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. My pleasure. Love to talk about the Roberts. Love to talk about Navy stuff. So I appreciate it.
It's been a great night. Thanks a lot, Brad. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of VidRats. And until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Goddamn.